This podcast is a presentation of UCTV.tv, University of California Television. Like what you learn? Help others discover UCTV podcasts by leaving a comment or rating in iTunes.
Thanks, everybody, for giving me the opportunity to present on behalf of our team. And since this is a lunchtime presentation, my goal here is to keep it easily digestible. Direct your attention to my disclosures. I do have IP related to this technology, and there is a startup company, which I will mention as we go along. So the first thing is to consider what it is we're trying to treat. And in that venue, we're looking at the retinal degenerations. And retinal degenerations is actually a broad category of diseases, and here I illustrate two. One that we're concentrating on, retinitis pigmentosa, which is a rare hereditary disease, and I contrast it to age-related macular degeneration, which is a quite common disease that, as the name implies, is related to aging. So RP may be an orphan disease, but that gives it certain regulatory benefits, and it also provides a low-hanging fruit in terms of a clinical therapy because of the specificity of the lesion in this disease. So when we're talking about retinal degenerations, we're talking about the rods and cones. Those are the photoreceptors in the back of the retina. These are the cells that initiate the entire visual process. So without those cells, the vision cannot even get off the ground, so to speak. So rods and cones are critical initial step in vision. And in retinitis pigmentosa, it's the rod photoreceptors that are lost. Unfortunately, the loss of the rod photoreceptors, which results in night blindness, which in itself isn't such a big problem, is then followed up by a mysterious problem where the cones also die. And then the patients develop tunnel vision and eventually lose all vision. So that's the problem there. Now, age-related macular degeneration develops late in life, and so it involves just the central vision and the periphery of the retina is spared. However, this lesion involves multiple layers right in the center of the eye. So when the doctor looks in the back of the eye in a patient with RP, it looks quite different than in a patient with macular degeneration. What you see in RP, as the name implies, is a speckled pigmentary pattern in the back of the eye. And that relates to the disease process where the rod photoreceptors are dying off and the pigment is reacting to this problem. And if you look in the back of the eye of a patient with macular degeneration, what you see are drusen, these little light-colored deposits right under the center of the vision in the fovea. In addition, you can see pigmentary changes there as well, but this problem never spreads across the whole retina. So at the far right of the slide, you can see what this is like for the patient. At the top, you see the retinitis pigmentosa phenotype, and here we have a snapshot of the tunnel vision aspect. Remember, it starts as night blindness, it progresses to tunnel vision, and then complete blindness. In AMD, the center of vision is lost, and so people lose the ability to read. They have trouble with face recognition and driving, but the peripheral vision is still intact. All of these conditions have this underlying problem with the photoreceptors. Here is just an illustration of the histology in the retina. On the left-hand side, you see what a normal retina looks like when you've labeled it up with various fluorescent dyes to illustrate the layers of the retina. And in the green, you see the rod photoreceptors. And then on the right, you see a retina affected by RP, in which the rod photoreceptors are obviously going away. They're disappearing and falling apart, and it's quite disorganized. So that's the basic focal lesion in RP that we want to treat. And here I'm just going to pause a moment to go into this therapeutic strategy. So this is a little dry, but if you listen to this, you'll have some insight into exactly what it is we're trying to do and why it's such a simple approach. So first off, you got your rods and you got your cones. The rods are only important for the night vision. Most of the time, we don't use our rods. They're completely saturated with light and they don't contribute to our vision. It's only in a moonless night kind of situation that the rods really come into play. And then it's the rods that are expressing the mutations that give you RP. So the problem starts in the rod. It's a mutation. And there's over 3,000 known mutations that can give you RP. So the take-home message from that is that it's not one mutation, one disease, like sickle cell anemia or Huntington's disease. You have a broad range of mutations all lead to this final pathway where the rod photoreceptors die. And the point I want to make is that rod photoreceptors, even in RP, are functioning normally when the patient is a young child. So they can see like you and I can, even though they have the mutation. And then for some reason, those rod photoreceptors die off. So there's a little bit of a disconnect where we have a clinical opportunity to try and stop that process where the mutation indirectly results in the rod death. And even at that point, the patient only has the night blindness, which you can basically treat with a flashlight. So we want to interrupt the problem where we get to the cones, and there's this bystander effect where the cones die off. The cones are what humans use for almost all of their vision. Even at night, if you're driving a car with headlights, you're using mainly your cones. So if we can preserve the cones, we can really help the patient. We can basically effectively treat this disease. So the cones are just a bystander effect. They're not even expressing the mutation involved. So what we really need is, and here I'm just coining a new phrase I just made up, a pro-retinogenic effect. We want something to go into that retina to tell the cones, basically, you know, you feel sick, you're dying, but it's all a hoax. Stop it. It's just a farce. Turn around, get back to work. And we've literally treated the patient at that point. And one of the interesting caveats to that is if you see a patient who's lost considerable vision, it doesn't necessarily mean that their cones are all gone, because the cone is going to start from a healthy state. It's going to go through an intermediate state where it's sick, and then it's finally going to die. And it's those sick cones that can no longer provide vision but could be resuscitated and be brought back online to contribute to vision. That's really one of the main targets of our therapy, and we think we can make an impact there. So where's this pro-retinogenic influence going to come from? And that's where our type of stem cell comes in. So what we're working with are retinal progenitor cells. These are not true stem cells. They can't make every cell in the body. They can only make retinal cell types. But they're naturally pre-specified by the body during development to generate the retina. So you could say that their job description is to make a retina. So they're very pro-retinogenic because that's what they do for a living, make retina. And they can't be turned into other tissues, but that's okay if we concentrate our efforts on retinal disease. We have no interest in making pancreas or liver inside the retina. So in the end, that's actually a benefit. Another really interesting aspect of these cells is they're not immunogenic. And what that means is if you have a liver transplant or a kidney transplant, you know that the tissues have to be tissue typed. They have to be matched, the donor to the recipient. And even then, typically, the recipients have to go on an immune suppressive therapy to avoid rejecting the organ. That's not the case here. These cells can come from an unrelated donor. They can go straight in the eye with no immune suppression. So clinically speaking, that greatly simplifies the procedure, and it decreases the risk to the patient. It basically lowers the bar. And so retinitis pigmentosa may be a rare disease, but it's very inviting as an opportunity to make an impact in a neural degeneration. As you know, there are many types of neural degenerations, and these are a vast array of unmet medical needs. Retinitis pigmentosa, by just affecting that rod photoreceptor and then the cone sitting right next to it, this is an incredibly specific lesion. And if you can't treat RP, you're going to have a really tough time trying to treat some of these much more complicated conditions in the brain. So what I'm saying is, from a clinical perspective, this is a low-hanging fruit. We should be able to take care of this, and that will provide a lot of impetus to curing all these other neural degenerations. So here's our proof of concept. Here's where it gets a little technical, and I'll try to keep it simple. But look first at the image on the left. What you see is basically what our treatment looks like if you had a view inside the eye. So what we do is we grow the cells in the lab, we harvest them, and then they get injected into the jelly in the back of the eye. So that's a very simple procedure. That's not really surgery per se. I'm not saying it's a flu shot, but it's pretty close. It's closer to that than open heart surgery, let me tell you. So the patient gets topical anesthesia, they're awake, the injection takes a few seconds, the cells are in the jelly. Then what do? They cluster with each other. They prefer to stick to each other. So they basically form that big ball. That's the graft. These balls look big on an image like this, but they're actually microscopic. And in the most extreme cases, they're only going to be a few millimeters across, even with our highest dosage. So we're talking about actually little clusters of cells at the head of a pin in the jelly of the eye, and they're just floating there, and they don't need immune suppression. And what are they going to do? Well, they just sit there, and they exert their pro-retinogenic influence. So they're going to secrete all the factors they normally do secrete during retinal development, and those factors are going to diffuse into the retina, which you see arching above the graft. And when those factors get into the retina, we believe they're going to reprogram the photoreceptors into becoming functional again instead of going down that road where they're going to commit suicide. So it's just a matter of reprogramming that retina to save those cones, and that's a huge treatment. What you see in the middle, this splayed out cross-like thing, is actually a rat retina. So that's a retina from a rat with retinal degeneration. That's our animal model called the RCS rat. This is a way of mounting a retina so that you can look at it microscopically without slicing it up. And then those four funny black areas are just zones where the special microscope is going to zoom in and look at the photoreceptor layer and see what's going on. And then we're going to compare a retina from an animal with degeneration who has a sham treatment to an animal that's had the cell treatment and see if there's any difference in the photoreceptors. Now, if you look at the upper right, you see something labeled control, and it looks like a blank frame, and that's because it is blank. The photoreceptors, which would appear in red or green colors, are absent because of the degeneration, so they're basically gone. And if you look at the cell-treated sample just below it, you see, like stars in the sky, a lot of little green spots and red spots. The red are rod photoreceptors, and the green are the middle wavelength cone photoreceptors. And those have been preserved because of the presence of those cells just floating, hanging there in the vitreous, secreting what they secrete. And interestingly, you see not only are the cones preserved, but also the rods. So this pro-retinogenic effect seems to be not specific just for the cones, but involves both the types of photoreceptors. And it may well have the similar impact on any type of retinal neuron. So it's great to say that the rods and cones are still there, but it's important to demonstrate that they are still functional. Because if you have the photoreceptors but they're not doing anything, you haven't really helped the patient. We have three different ways of looking at function in these animals. The one in the upper left illustrates a behavioral assay in which the animals are basically put in a virtual drum with spinning stripes, and we see if their head flicks back and forth, and it will only flick back and forth if they can see those stripes. So by varying the size of the stripe and the drum, you can tell whether the animal has the ability to see the stripe. And obviously, if you make fine pinstripes and the animal still flicks their head, then that means they have good acuity. So what that little bar graph is showing is that the cell-treated eyes see better than the controls. But the behavioral tests aren't really that definitive. And so we like to do electrophysiology, in which case we actually put electrodes in the area of the eye to get actual recordings from the electrical circuits to make sure everything's really intact. So there's two different versions. The one in the upper right-hand side shows you electrophysiology from the brain that tests how well the signals are getting from the eye back to the brain. And what you see in the red line is the cell-treated eyes that are seeing better than the other eyes. So that's one indication that the retina in the treated animals are more sensitive to light. And at the bottom, we tested another way, and this is the electroretinogram. And what's good about this is that's the same test that's used in RP patients. So the clinically relevant test in a human is this ERG. And the reason we were reluctant to try this in rats is because the rat eye is so tiny, the ERG signal is quite small. But interestingly, we were able to show, and that's what this graph indicates, is that the treated animals do see better than the controls, and the treated ones are the three blue bars to the left. So we use different doses and still got the rescue effect based on this electrode that just sits on the outside of the eye. Anyway, three different ways of showing that we do have visual restoration in these rats. From there, we get into the preclinical part of the project where we manufacture the cells. These cells are manufactured up at a GMP facility that CIRM supports at UC Davis. We've generated five different lots of these cells and qualified them for the upcoming clinical trials. And as part of our submission to the FDA, we've also done extensive toxicology studies to demonstrate the safety of these cells. And I just illustrate three different aspects of this very broad and complex study. The first part is I show you a complement of normal chromosomes up here at the top. That means that we have to look at the cells and show that their chromosomes are normal and characterize the cells very thoroughly to show that they're not contaminated and so on and so forth. In the lower left, you see a mouse eye. So we have to transplant the cells to the jelly of the eye in these mice and show that this doesn't impact the eye in any bad way. So what you see there is a normal mouse eye, and you see the little clump of cells in the graft sitting there just fine, and nothing bad is happening to the retina. So that's safety, no tumor formation, no retinal detachment, so on and so forth. And then on the lower right, you see a complicated study in which we basically look for DNA fingerprints elsewhere in the mouse. So you put the cells in the eye, and then you wait certain periods of time, and you say, well, did these cells stay in the eye, or did they show up in the brain? Did they end up in the liver? And you have to check the kidneys and the bone marrow and so on and so forth. So what that slide shows is that the cells did not leave the eye. So that's really good from a safety standpoint. So here's our current status. We have a disease team therapy award from CIRM, which has made this all possible. We're about halfway through that. So the midpoint is our application to the FDA, which we're working on. We've also partnered with the TREND program from NIH that supports efforts to bring therapies forward for orphan diseases. And this is the first time they've adopted a stem cell project. There's a startup company, as I mentioned at the beginning, called J-Sight, and that's there to develop this from a commercial standpoint. And J-Sight so far has licensed the patent from the UC Regents. So our next step is our big application to the FDA, and that's imminent, and we're working on it night and day at this point. And once that goes through without a hitch, we hope, then we can start the trial and RP, and so we're looking at hopefully early next year. Looking beyond RP, as I mentioned, hopefully this will apply to other retinal conditions, including AMD, but also other situations where retinal neurons are lost, both on the photoreceptor side, but also potentially in the optic nerve. And I'd like to thank all of you for your support and the members of the lab and also all our collaborators at Cedars-Sinai, at UC Santa Barbara, UC Davis, and at the NIH. Thank you very much.
Any questions for Dr. Klassen? Dr. Lubin?
So that was a great presentation. I graduated from Pitt Medical School, so I'll have to say hello about that afterwards. So the cells produce a cytokine that stimulates cells to recover. Is that what the story is? Or are the cells that you put in actually grow in the retina? I wasn't clear on that.
Yeah, so much of our earlier work was directing these cells towards cell replacement, which is the kind of traditional way of going about this. And we have shown that you can make new photoreceptors. In the process, we discovered this neuroprotective effect, which from a clinical standpoint, and I tried to go through the rationale, that really makes sense in terms of helping patients right now. So yes, they secrete a cytokine profile. We characterize that. We've actually looked at certain individual cytokines, and at least one of them can reproduce the rescue effect in and of itself, although it appears to be less than what the cells do, so we're entertaining a cocktail effect. Yes?
So what's the long-term fate of the cell?
That's a good point. So the cells survive very well in the vitreous for an extended period, but they're not going to survive as well as they would if they were engrafted. If they were engrafted, they'd have a blood supply, and obviously they'd do better. So they do sit there, they differentiate. The vitreous is a relatively nourishing place, but eventually the grafts do shrink with time, and we've got long-term studies that, although the graft's still there, you can see it's getting smaller. So we anticipate that these cells are going to go away. One thing is that when they go away, we think the cytokine effect will be lost with them. One thing is, though, it may already influence the course of the degeneration in a way that favors the treated eye in a long-term basis. In other words, you call that the parachute effect. But here's the really key thing. Because we're not going underneath the retina and injecting cells there, because this is a simple intravitreal injection, we could re-up the dose. So we could retreat these patients. And the key thing to consider there is whether, although these cells are immune privileged, whether retreating the eye would induce a graft rejection that wasn't there in the first place because the first one primed the system, so to speak. Right? You can't really test that with our model where we put human cells in RCS because we have to immune suppress the RCS rat because it's a xenograft. So what we've done is we have mouse retinal progenitor cells we put into mouse models, and we've looked at the tolerability of repeat dosing. And the data is just coming in this last week, and it looks very favorable. So even in the case that there was some induction of a rejection response, we think we could treat the patients to mitigate that. But mercifully, at least in the mouse, it looks like there isn't going to be a reaction. So that's really, really good news. And so what I'm saying is it looks like the potential to retreat is there.
Dr. Dulige.
Thank you for this very inspiring presentation about the hope that maybe you could give to patients. How far away or how rapidly do you think you can get into patients?
Well, we got to get the IND filed. We wait 30 days, then we got to do the IRB, and we're ready to roll.
Talking early next year?
Yeah, as early as possible.
Very good. Well, that will be a coup. Great.
Give you a sense of what it's like going through the disease RP. We have a patient here, and that's Rosalinda and her husband, Herman, and they're going to talk to you briefly to give you a sense of what they're going through and how much they have invested in this.
Okay. Hi, everyone. It's me again. I saw you, I think, 2.5 years ago. I'm so excited. I can't see any of you, and that's kind of helpful because I have a fear of speaking in public. So they told me it's an empty room. I'm so excited. You know, I can't wait to be the recipient of this. I've lived my whole life with this. And I was reminding my daughters that I didn't like trick-or-treating because I couldn't see in the dark. I said, this is not fun. I'm tripping. I lost my candy. I wanted to stay home and hand out candy. Mostly I want this because I'm a mom, and I would be such a better mom if I could drive them around. And it's right now it's my husband. He's dedicated his whole, our entire marriage to taking care of me and our son with autism. So I'm just, I want to do my part too. So thank you.
She's doing her part. She does more than people that are sighted. And anyways, we're humbled by the work that you're all doing. The last meeting we attended, our first meeting was 2 years ago in July up in San Francisco. And we learned a lot. I'm now receiving the emails from the group, and I'm anxious to see the taxpayers' dollars really do life-changing work. And something like this, even though it's not a deadly disease, it is a life-changing, it would be life-changing not only for Rosie, it'd be for everybody around her. And we met because she couldn't see. She tried to get in, if you recall those of you that were on the board, she tried getting in my car thinking I was someone else when I was parking, and her date went off to get his car, and I got to that parking space first, and she... But in any case, because it seems like Rosie can see, because her eyes are, they're just slowly deteriorating. I would always challenge her, and I would tell her. I feel like I was that pro retinal janitor, I think is what you called it. I feel like I've been a pro janitor, a retinal janitor, like pushing Rosie to, come on, you can do it. And maybe it was because I had at one point lived with somebody that was blind, and we'd go skiing, and the person would have to completely trust us that there wasn't a tree in front of him, and he would just follow our guidance, just being completely blind. And so I, having that training in my college years of just having lived with someone that was blind, I think I was prepared to then now help Rosie really push and go beyond her lack of vision. Anyways, I would always treat her, no, you could see, and it's not...
On the way here, he asked me if I could see the tractors, and I said...
So you're going to see the tractors?
No.
And I asked my... We brought our daughters with us. We didn't know there was an ICOC meeting today. We thought we were just going to do a taping. But we brought our daughters, and Amalim, our youngest, yesterday she confessed to me that she thought... She said, Mommy could see until the one time that... how old were you, Emily, when you finally believed that Mommy had a lack of vision? You were 7. So about 5 years ago, she said, we were crossing the street, and mommy hit the, there was one of these curbs in the center of the island, you know, this like a little island, and mommy didn't see it. And she tripped and fell on the street. And everybody could see.
No, I didn't fall. Because I'm a professional faller.
Okay.
So I caught myself. I just bent my knee down. I'm like, oh, I've done this before. Yeah, this isn't my first rodeo.
Yeah, that's happened at the Hollywood Bowl. You know, many places where, you know, I wasn't really, I've learned to be, to guide her. But it's, you know, people think that she can see because she looks in your direction. She can see the shadows, and there's many people that are losing their sight, and it would be life changing. And we just want to applaud you for all the work that you're doing. Applaud Dr. Clausen. He's a humble man.
He's a hero.
He doesn't have this big organization behind him, you know, pushing and, you know, with advocates and everything. We advocate for our son who has autism that can't be left alone, and it's hard for us to start a foundation, but we, as soon as this goes forward, we will be your biggest spokespeople to attract people to the state of California for the treatment of this and other eye diseases. So thank you again for all the work that you do.
You've been listening to a podcast by University of California Television. For more information about this program or UCTV, visit us online at uctv.tv.